Thank you for tuning in to the Afternoon Pint Podcast. Our show will start right after these messages from our sponsors.
Hey, Matt. We're thinking of selling our home and finding a bigger place.
Oh, really? I thought you guys loved where you lived.
Oh, we do. Our family is just growing. With pets. A dog. A cat. Two guinea pigs. A hamster.
And you're planning on getting more?
Maybe a goat or a crocodile.
Well, I have the person for you. Kimina Jad is an experienced real estate agent who prides herself in finding the perfect home for her clients.
We're just browsing now. I'm not sure if we really need a realtor yet.
Yeah, no worries. Kimina can help you with the comparative market analysis to help you determine the value of your home if you're planning on selling, or help you determine the going rate for the neighborhood you're moving into. She can also work at your pace.
Awesome. All right, I'll give her a shot. What's her phone number?
On Facebook, Kimina Jad, Exit Realty Metro. Her phone number is 902-880-8429, and her email is kimia@exitmetro.ca.
902-880-8429. Awesome. Thanks.
This podcast was brought to you by Dan Lomas. That's L-O-M-A-S of lomasfinancial.ca.
Are you a small business owner who wants to keep more of your hard-earned profits and pay less taxes to the CRA? Do you want a plan for a comfortable and secure retirement? If your answer is yes, then you need to talk to Dan Lomas at Lomas Financial.
Dan Lomas is a financial advisor who has been helping successful entrepreneurs and business owners for over 2.5 decades. He utilizes customized solutions that can help you keep your earnings, dramatically reducing passive income tax.
Dan Lomas and his team will help you transition corporate wealth into personal wealth by utilizing customized executive pension plans. Dan will show you how to convert business wealth into personal wealth in a professional manner.
Don't let the CRA take more money than they deserve. Don't let your retirement dreams fade away. Contact Dan Lomas today and let him guide you on your path to financial success.
Visit Dan Lomas at lomasfinancial.ca or call him direct at 902-209-0855. That's 902-209-0855.
This is Matt Conrad.
And this is Mike Tobin.
Welcome to the Afternoon Pint.
This week we speak with Tim Brody. Tim has had an amazing career, including 30 years with the Department of National Defense, RCMP, and the Police Leadership Academy of Canada. He currently operates his own business, The Brodies, which helps provide people therapeutic counseling. We really enjoyed this chat. Enjoy.
Hey, Afternoon Pint. You're joining us at Serpent Brewing today. You're enjoying a Drama Llama Double IPA, our Father O'Keefe Triple Belgian, and joining us from Big Spruce, the non-alcoholic kitchen, Partly.
Awesome. Thank you so much. All right, guys. Cheers.
All right. Cheers.
This is fantastic.
Yeah, so today we have, I'm very, very honored to, I guess in some case, return the favor to Tim Brody and have him on our podcast on the Afternoon Pint tonight, today, this afternoon, whatever you want to call it. But yeah, so we have Tim Brody on the show. So Tim actually has quite a bit of background. For me to sum it up is going to take this entire podcast. So we're going to talk about some of the history of what he's kind of been doing. One thing I want to start it off with a gift that Tim brought with us. We gave him a gift of our new glasses that we have.
It's fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you. And he also came bearing kind of a coffee mug. But what's really cool is he came with this coin. You know, we may actually end up taking a picture of this and putting it up there so people can see it. But Tim, why don't you explain the coin? You told us the history of it, and this is my third one, so it's really cool that you'll be able to explain this to us.
It says PLDA on it.
Yes.
Police Leadership Development Academy. On the other side, it says appreciation and inclusion.
And respect.
Oh, yeah. And respect. My thumb was over.
That your thumb, yeah. So, yeah, Tim, give us the story and the background on this.
Well, look, challenge coins are something that I used to experience back in the military. And in the military, I was in the military for 30 years. And in the military, a challenge coin is something that belongs to an organization or a unit. And in the military, when you join a unit, it's really, truly about family. And, you know, as Simon Sinek says, it's not like family. It's about family. And we know from our experiences in the research that the bonds that get formed in those high-stress environments are stronger, in fact, than the mother and child bond. And so in the military, when you belong to a squadron or a unit and you get a challenge coin, it's the epicenter of pride, your expression of pride for that unit. So if you're in a bar or a military mess, for example, and you know, picture all the guys bellied up to the bar, and they're ordering a drama llama, and one of the guys pulls out his challenge coin and slams it onto the bar. Everyone else should be able to pull out their coin and slam it down as an acknowledgement. Yes, 436 Squadron, for instance, is here. The fellow that can't is the fellow that ends up having to buy the round. And so that was the background from it. Interestingly enough, in my 30-year career, I think I only ever got two or three coins. They were really, really coveted, and you didn't give them away willy-nilly. After I left the military, I went and worked with the police. And so the PLD, the coin that you have, is from one of the businesses that I created, the Police Leadership Development Academy. And we go around, Fons McNeil and I, and we help folks in the first responder community learn leadership skills. And in the police environment, first responder environment, my gosh, they trade these things like playing cards. They're just cool.
Is it just police, or is it like paramedics?
And it's paramedics, fire,
all frontline.
Cool. Yeah, all frontline, and so it's like trading cards. I think that since I started working in the police environment, I think I have about 30 coins.
Wow,
which is 10 times more than I had from my 30-year career in the military.
That's very cool. I mean, I actually managed to have three, so, you know, it'd be pretty cool to actually have 30 someday. I'd probably put those all up and, like, line them all up. But then, of course, if you line them all up and frame them, you're going to be buying a lot of drinks.
That's exactly right.
How do you carry 30 of these things around?
Do you know, my friend Fons, he's been all around the world working with different police organizations. In fact, really, really cool story. He was working in the Ukraine. Oh. In the Ukraine, they disbanded all their police and reformed it, trying to get rid of corruption. So mm-hmm. he was one of the Canadians that went over to train folks about police organizations. And Fons is a good Nova Scotia boy. And so there's a Nova Scotian son that went overseas representing everything that's good and noble about being Canadian in a country that was looking up to us. So when he went over there, when he was coming back, I can't remember which country it was, but on his way back, I think it was France, he stopped for an experience with some of the French police, and they brought out a challenge coin that was about the size of a small dinner plate.
Oh.
they do things large there.
Wow. Yeah. So you spent 30 years in the military. Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your experience there? Like, what was your specialty? What was the field you're in? And, mm-hmm. you know, how did that kind of shape you? I know I joined at a young age. What age did you join?
Oh, my. Yeah, I was 22 when I joined. I was 20 when I tried to sign up. It was a long, long, long experience. But I recall when I joined, my dad was the real pressure behind that, because in the early 80s, the economy was just tanked. And so my dad kept saying, you should join the military, you should join the military, you should join the military. But everyone knows when your dad tells you what to do, it's the last thing you want to do, right? Yeah. But he was right. And so I joined the military in 1983 in May, just before my 23rd birthday. And it's funny, because I graduated from basic training, and my last course report said, this man is a weak recruit and will never benefit the Canadian military.
Huh.
Off I went on my trades training, and I went with a fire of contempt underneath my arse.
Yeah.
From that last stinging comment. And so I topped the course, and I got a picture of myself getting the top student award. And I wrote on the back of it, FU, and I put the picture in an envelope and I send it back to the warrant officer in Cornwallis.
Good job.
Nice.
I like that.
Yeah, yeah, I love it. I definitely live my life with that chip on the shoulder.
But you know,
in a good way.
But the story I told myself was this, because I never did hear anything. Mm-hmm. The story I told myself was that, you know, this warrant officer, Butch Montrell was his name, he must have got that picture and looked at it, flipped it over, and then in his own mind said, knew he could do it. That's the story I told myself.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Until about a year ago, I was doing some training. I was teaching folks in the military how to be with other military folks that are suffering from post-traumatic stress issues, and veterans how to be with current serving members. And in my class that I was running online for Veterans Affairs, this guy pops up.
Oh.
And it's Butch Montrell.
Whoa. Oh.
And I gotta tell you, like, it was, I mean, 1983, you know, this is 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And I see his face come up on my computer screen, and instantly every sphincter in my muscle just locked shut.
Oh, my gosh. God,
it's Butch Montrell. It's Butch Montrell.
Now, did he remember you?
No, no. Oh, of course, you know.
Okay. He's probably had so many people come through.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I had the chance to ask him. I told him the story, and I said, you know, I tell this story all the time, Butch, and you know, it's just such an inspirational story for me, and I wanted to share it with you because I want to, you know, tell you what my mind told me. And so I told him the story about sending the picture, and he said, I can guarantee you I never received that picture.
Oh, wow.
Because if I did, the comment wouldn't have been, knew he could. He's 40 years later, he's still the meanest man I've ever met in my life.
Wow.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, so, you know what, though? Some of the greatest coaches are... unfortunately that, but you know, you look back on it and think, like, you know, he pushed me to where I needed to be.
It was
and all
inspirational.
That stuff, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So then, so you spent 30 years in the military, and then you started working for the RCMP.
Mm.
So what was your role in there? I mean, jumping from, I know a lot of people can jump from military to police, but it's not exactly the same thing.
You know, I was stunned. So my last 30-year career, my last 10 years was spent working with teams deploying into Afghanistan. And we created really, really novel approaches to increase effectiveness and efficiencies in high-stress environments. And we ended up decreasing operational stress injuries by introducing collaborative relationship skills. And as a result of all that, I was sent up to Rideau Hall, and I met the Governor General, and they inducted me into the Order of Military Merit. It's kind of Canada's equivalent of knighthood. That was lovely to tell Butch Montrell, hey, the guy who would never benefit the Canadian military. And, you know, part of that process was the notion of, you know, when you talk about pride in your accomplishments, I mean, the greatest moment of pride I had wasn't while I was in Rideau Hall being inducted into the order and seeing my dad in the back of the room with his face filled with pride. You know, that was a really great experience, but that wasn't the best. The best experience was when I was up in Petawawa, and there was a tank commander that had taken our training who came home and said, because of your training, my crew and I are alive today. So there's four fewer body bags in Canada because of the relationship skills training that we taught. And so, I was medically released from the military. Then the RCMP asked me to come and work with them, ostensibly to replicate some of the successes we had in the military. And I thought, well, you know, it'll be an easy transition. It's a military to a paramilitary, you know, hierarchical, all the same. But I started doing a ton of research before I went over because I wanted to know the difference in the client base. And what I found was astonishing. See, the... And this took me about a year working inside the RCMP, and it took the Moncton shooting and all those things that I experienced with that team to realize that the military is a training organization that goes operational. So I had a 30-year career, 10 years was spent hyperactive around situations like Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The police is an operational environment that tries to squeeze in training.
Right.
It's the polar opposite.
Different.
Right.
So incredibly different, and the operational stresses then that hit are completely different as well. And the other manifest difference is that while we in the military, we went over there to do those hard things that our community wanted us to do, that the police do them right here every day. Yeah. And I started realizing when I was in the RCMP that I was really walking the hall with heroes, people that would put their lives on the line for a complete stranger at a moment's notice. It showed with the Moncton shooting, and it showed again with a mass casualty situation that we had here in Nova Scotia. Mm. Really good people that would sacrifice everything that they have and all that they are for a complete stranger. And I thought, these guys are just incredible. Every police officer, not just RCMP, but they all will. And it was humbling.
Mm. Yeah, it's, I guess that kind of like can lead into some of the kind of that deeper discussion. I mean, you know, when we first kind of got here, we kind of talked about the whole, the idea of defunding the police. And I think we all share the same opinion that was, poor branding, I guess.
I think so.
Because, I mean, defunding doesn't necessarily mean not giving funding. But you said it really well. Like, police are doing too much. Mm. And I know when you and I chatted before, you know, I had political aspirations. And
I sure hope you still do.
At some point.
I really, really do that the universe needs more Matt Conrad.
I very humbly appreciate that. Yeah, there's probably a lot of people who don't agree with that. But anyway, that being said, I think the defunding part is interesting because, you know, and we'll get into this a little bit further on what you're doing now. But I think it's either that police either need more training in some of the mental health type situations or how to handle those situations, because a lot of it's trained to fight the bad guy. How do you handle people who aren't bad people? They just aren't in the mental capacity, and it's tough. So it's either we have a situation of, do we train police or do we restructure things so that we have those specialists on the police payroll to assist? And I mean, I don't know if you have you know, opinion on that, or
and I'm not to pile on with what Matt just said, but it would be really nice if people had the opportunity to view the police as peacekeepers, ones that are there to help them, ones that are there to support them. I do feel sometimes in certain communities, people are afraid of the police, quite frankly, and they're scared. Like, you know, they're afraid that something's going to happen or something's going to escalate that shouldn't escalate, and It's a dangerous ground, right? You got to see both sides of perspectives, right? There were statistics out about, I really don't want to get into this too far, but about a black men or black people being, you know, pulled over more proportionally than white people, right? And that's real, right? Mm-hmm. From the data they collected, and I'm sure that they're doing things to help with that. But yeah, I guess that's. I know I can understand the I always try to understand both sides. And I'll tell you, for one, I definitely want police in the world at the same time, because I'd be very scared in a world without any kind of policing.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I can't understand the perspectives of the people that feel like they're left out of the equation and they don't feel as served, or the perspective that they don't feel as served as much as they might feel like a radical injustice, that they might just get in trouble if they get caught, right? And I sympathize with that too, right?
Yeah. You know, I've not served in uniform with the police. I've served beside them as a mediator and coach, and so I can't tell you about their specific encounters and that the nature of the relationship with communities. I think it's a sad testimony or a sad statement when people are. Or feel like they're being judged because of the color of their skin, and a conclusion is predetermined. I think that's horrifically horrific and sad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with Fonts and I, Fonce McNeil is Fonce. The fellow I'm talking about.
Okay.
He's the guy that wrote the McNeil report after the Moncton shooting. And,
okay, yeah.
And he took the stand defending the need for the RCMP to hasten its training processes and change some of the things that are going on. But he and I have worked with Indigenous communities up in Labrador.
Okay.
And we've seen some of the optics and the determinations that are made about people from that community instinctively and seen how wrong that is. I mean, Fonce's wife was raised on a reserve out west, and Fonce has a really, really tight bond with the Indigenous community.
Good.
And we both are saddened by some of the things around that get seen around the Black community. But the reality is that one of the really, really big distinctions between a police community and a military community is that the military community is the warrior community.
Right.
We go off to fight.
Right.
The police community is the guardian community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And people really need to understand that difference. You know, when I was, for instance, working the Kosovar refugee crisis and bringing the refugees here into Nova Scotia and meeting them firsthand. I'm a dad. I've got five kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember seeing this one little kid whose family had all been killed because of their religion, and no one was willing to claim him. And he had a grievous injury across his face because he'd been hit by the butt of a rifle in the face because he was Muslim. Mm. And so I was in my uniform, and he came off the plane, this terrified little boy, and I instantly thought of my own kids. And so I went down on one knee to embrace him, and he saw my uniform, and he ran screaming the other way.
For sure.
Because it was a fellow in uniform who'd done that to him.
Yeah.
Right.
And I used that story when I talked to the police because I said, here's the difference I want you to understand. He's right to do that.
Right.
Right.
Where should he run? He should run towards the police. The police need to be held as the guardians and the place that you run to. So I think that there's a lot of healing and a lot of conversations that we have to have in our communities to rebuild those relationships with the police. They're not bad. They're really, really
good. No, and I mean, to double down on what you said earlier, they're not bad people by any stretch of the imagination. I got to work with some RCMP officers as an actor, and I had a ton of fun as helping them through exercise training scenarios, and it was a paid gig, so I took it, and it was a real pleasure. I did it four or five times, and I mean, if anything, it made me really appreciate these guys a lot more on what they're doing, how much they care.
I'm glad
and their and their dedication, right? So, I mean, I'm not trying to make a mark, but I'm trying to say, look, I mean, there's a lot of healing that's there and a lot of hurt that's there. And,
that's it.
And the segregation. And it's just been for so long, right? Yeah. And it's just something that just, unfortunately, our media doesn't help. When something happens, it's publicized, and I'd say multiple media channels have multiple views on it, and it becomes the most important story in the nation sometimes. And to see an active focus on that would be beautiful. I think it'll be part of the healing process, right? And make sure people feel part of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, and that's a good perspective. I think that's an interesting perspective, and also a very good perspective of having that story to be able to tell, to hit home with where, what one person interprets as something to run to is that another person can interpret as something to run away from.
Yeah.
And
I mean, don't get me wrong. It hurt my soul.
Of course. It's
sure.
Okay, but, but the reality is he was right to do that.
Yeah.
In the military, we're warriors.
Right.
And we're not there to make you safe. We're there to enforce a perspective. And
that's right.
And as difficult
and
as
there
it
must
seems.
Be bonding. Probably racial boundaries probably eliminate when you have a common enemy or a common objective, I would say, right? Same as like when Will Smith's defending us from aliens, right? Everybody in the movie seems to be together at that point, right? We're all focused on something
that's
bigger
than
us or greater than us.
That's right. That's right. Do you know, it's funny, when I was working in Trenton and I was teaching these communication skills. So we were having such a great impact that I started to think we're missing part of the defense team. And so I started opening up two seats on every course that I ran for military spouses. Mm-hmm. So spouses come in because we need to take care of the home front as well.
Okay.
And then I take 2 weeks of holidays every year and I go teach this to the children as well. And so I teach collaborative communication skills to kids. And at the Military Family Resource Center in Trenton, one of the women came up and said, Tim, you're really good at this, and we wondered, would you put together a workshop for men? And I said, well, sure. What should the workshop be about? And, well, getting men to connect with their emotions. And I said, oh, because men don't connect with their emotions? And she said, no. And so we think that you could teach men how to connect with their emotions. And I said, I got an idea for you. How about I run a course for women on how to understand how men connect with their emotions? Because if you've ever been to a ramp ceremony where there's a flag draped box going up there, you'll see a lot of emotion. Men do express emotions. Mm. It's just different. And so,
it's why I cry at every Adam Sandler and Joe Dirt movie sad part, right? Yeah. Yeah. Like, oh gosh, I don't know why this is touching my soul.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's interesting to kind of hear a lot of this because it's what I like about the perspective that you bring, and this isn't a big reason why I want to kind of have you on here, is you come obviously from a perspective, and we'll get into this shortly because you have a book and you've had your own podcast and all this type of stuff. So you come from a military policing background, but you're coming from a really a point of like understanding, which and kind of really thinking a little bit deeper and a little bit broader. Mm. And sometimes you don't always get that narrative from people who come from a policing military background. So now you've taken a lot of your leadership skills and you've taken them, you've had them obviously in the military, you've had them in the RCMP, but what kind of decided to make you like really switch careers? And I guess we can talk about like the Mo Mondays. You brought these types of things in where you were talking about you want to talk to inspirational people and talk to people who are regular folks who were leaders in the communities. Like, what really kind of drew you to that?
Well, that's another story. Yeah. I'd left the military, spent my 5 years with the RCMP, which was the thing that I'd promised them. And when the 5 years came up, I knew that I wanted to do something else with my life. You know, you guys are still young. There'll be a point when suddenly you start hearing the clock tick and you get reminded of how finite this experience actually is. Mm-hmm. And, I was hearing the clock tick and I thought, well, Brody, if you're going to do something with your life, it's time to do it. And so from my experience working with the police, I thought, you know what I'd really like to do? I'd really like to put together a TED Talk. And I'm talking about a full day event. And I'm going to bring in Lieutenant Colonel. I'm going to bring in Romeo Dallaire.
We're going to cover that in a bit, too.
Yeah. And I'm going to bring in Roger Brown from Moncton, the Moncton situation. And I'm bringing all these really, really great warriors and guardians who were battling post-traumatic stress and pose one question to them. If you could go back to the day before that event happened that caused you to trip into post-traumatic stress, what's the advice you'd give your younger self? Because us older folks need to be passing on this wisdom to move the yardsticks further down the field.
Right.
And so I thought, you know, a full day of talks with workshops around creating resilience around post-traumatic stress rather than trying to manage the situation after it happens. That would be fantastic. And then all the money from the ticket sales I donate to the Society of Atlantic Heroes, which was a really great not-for-profit that a guy by the name of Ken Hoffer was running.
We're going to get to that too.
Yeah. So that was the notion. Do a lot of good. Pass on a lot of advice to younger serving folks on how to increase your own resilience, and then put a bag of cash aside for the Society of Atlantic Heroes. And I thought, this is perfect. And I sent the application off to TED Global. And I got the response back that as noble as the day sounds, TED can never be used to raise funds for anything.
Oh.
So they denied my license.
Oh, wow. So okay.
I went into a corner, and being an ex-military guy, I cursed, swore, berated the heavens, licked my wounds, and came back out and said, I'll teach you. So instead of having an annual TED Talk, I created a monthly Mo Mondays.
Right.
So Mo Mondays was an opportunity down at the Carlton where I'd get five folks that would talk about their post-traumatic stress situation mm-hmm. with this one caveat. No talking about PTSD. What I want you to talk about is post-traumatic growth. So share your story with your community so that little thread can be woven into the tapestry of the tartan that is us.
Right.
And so that people could understand what you do and what you did for them. And you can see the acceptance and acknowledgement, and that'll be part of your healing. So post-traumatic growth, tell me your story, but tell me what you learned from it, not how it hurt you. And we did it once a month instead of once a year. And then COVID happened. COVID happened.
It seems to be a common theme in this show, Matt. And then COVID happened. We had something great going for like 5 to 6 weeks, and then COVID ruined everything.
Yeah, well, we did it for about a year and a half.
Oh, a year and a half. Okay,
and
great.
And then COVID hit, and I tried to do it online, and Matt, you know, you and I talked. You were part of that.
Yeah.
And then it eventually just kind of died its own death.
Yeah.
But that was the Mo Monday story, and I gotta tell you, that was a lot of fun.
Mm.
A lot of fun. For anyone who's never been to the Carlton,
mm-hmm.
what a fantastic place. I mean, this city really is great.
Oh,
yeah.
It's
a great venue.
It's a beautiful sandbox. I love Halifax.
Yeah.
I came back here, moved once, came back because I missed my family and friends, and I don't think I'll leave again.
But the Carlton, God love them, never charged us a single cent.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was just open the doors. What you're doing is the right thing, mm-hmm. and we need to do the right thing because you're doing the right thing.
Wow, good for them.
Fantastic.
Fantastic?
Yeah.
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 Hats off to them forever and always.
Yeah.
Really, really great spot.
I think you're putting a lot of good, whatever you want to call it, good karma out into the world and things like that.
Mm.
When you get to have interesting conversations with people, but on top of that, kind of you get to motivate and inspire and help people, which is always a big thing for me. Like, you know, handling things with kindness and trying to leave, you know, the universe better off, a little bit better off, you know.
And helping people find the good out of their struggle is essentially what you do, right? Well, you're helping them find the learning from the pain. Know?
I mean, the reality is that every single one of us, I mean, no one gets out of this unscathed.
Right.
Every single one of us is going to face adversity.
Oh, yes.
And there's some people that just because the nature of what they volunteered to do on behalf of our community are going to face adversity at an extreme level.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so can I tell you just a bit of a backgrounder around that?
Yeah, please.
Sure, yeah. Love to.
So during the Afghanistan campaign, we had Walt Natinjik, who was the chief of defense staff at the time, and he sent out an email to the entire Canadian military, and he said this: here's my question for all of you. Can we bring our folks home better than we're doing right now? And he said, anyone that has an idea, send them up. And so I took on the challenge, and I thought, what's happening to our guys and girls that are going overseas? You know, what's happening to these great warriors? And it occurred to me that I needed to follow that thread. What does it mean to be a warrior? And so when I looked back and then I traced the thread back, it traced back to the Roman Empire. And so the Roman legions, which were the first military unit to use formed military units and strategic formed military plans, they were really successful, and they created this warrior mindset that when you go into battle, you become machine-like. They used false stoicism. Push down your emotions. Don't let them show. Mm-hmm. Become a
man. They used what, sorry?
False stoicism.
What does that mean?
So the Stoics were was a belief system that said embrace emotions and let's let's use them for the messages that they bring.
Okay.
The false Stoics said what it means is we actually push down emotions and we don't attend to them.
Okay.
And so with the Roman legions, they used this false Stoicism approach, and they became machine-like, and it was really effective, and it was terrifying. Mm. And they were successful over most of Europe, except for Scotland, where our people are from, because the Picts were there and they were crazy bastards. And they took over parts of Asia and parts of North Africa. It was huge. And then when the Roman Empire collapsed, the notion of warrior pervaded, and it was left behind as a legacy. So there's that notion of pushing down emotions, being machine-like, and that's what a warrior meant. And I thought, well, does every culture define a warrior that way? And so I thought, well, let me look around and check out other cultures. Well, I was in Trenton, just down the road from us, were the Mohawk and Tiendanaga. So I thought, well, let's check in with the Mohawk.
Right. Yeah.
I said, hey, what's it mean to be a warrior? And they said, not the same as what you think, Tim. In the warrior culture, in our community, when the warriors go out to kill animals or make war, they're not allowed back into their community. They have to light a smoky fire. The community sees the smoky fire and knows the war party's over there. The women and the shaman would go out and sit around the fire, and they comb the snakes from their hair. What does it mean to comb the snakes from your hair? Well, it means that you have to talk about every ill situation that you saw. You had to purge it from their soul. Huh. They said we had to, when we went to do those hard things, we had to put our heart in a dark place. When we came back, we had to reclaim our tender heart, become the brother, become the lover, become the husband, the father that we were before we left. And so I thought, well, what would it be like if instead of when our military guys landed in Cyprus coming home and they were told the beach is that direction with beer, the psychologist is that direction with beer, you get to choose where you want. What would it have been like instead if, as Canadians, we truly embraced the founding cultures of this land and said to our guys when they land in Cyprus, when you get there, there's a longhouse and there's a drum beating. You can go to the beach, but you have to go through the longhouse first. You have to comb the snakes from your hair. What would it have been like for Canadian military to have said to the British counterparts and the American counterparts, I'm sorry, this is part of our culture.
Mm.
We have to do this. We'll see you at the beach, but we have to comb the snakes from our hair first.
Interesting.
Yeah. When,
you know, I, it just seems to me that we've got French and English as the founding cultures of this country, and we've missed something really important. And it's not just to the detriment of our Indigenous friends.
Absolutely.
It's to our detriment as well.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
There's
so
much that we could learn from each other if we just got rid of the us and them barriers about the black and the white, about the red and the white, just...
Yeah,
and said, you know, we're all Canadians. Let's, let's really embrace what it means.
Make our whole nation incredibly strong.
Yeah, I think there's something to be said about. No matter your faith, I think there's something to be said about, you know, embracing that spirituality for healing and stuff like that, right? Like, you know, there's lots of people who are either atheist or agnostic, and there's still some sort of a spiritual healing that they can embrace. And
absolutely.
You know, whether it be just meditation or whatever. So, yeah, I love that. I think that's definitely something that could be explored and definitely something that we could, you know, look at as a... like a mandatory thing. Like you're coming back from overseas from fighting and being in a situation that's terrible. Let's comb those snakes out kind of thing, right? Like, let's give you some
time. It's something that's applicable in so many other situations as well. You know, imagine, you know, your kids going through a really, really tough time.
Mm.
I mean, you don't need to fix a sweet, blessed thing for them. All you have to do is help them process the emotion from that experience.
Sure. Right?
And that's really what was at the essence of combing the snakes. It was helping people process the emotion of the experience, not fixing a sweet, blessed thing.
Yeah.
And isn't that what we should do as community? We should just care about each other and listen to each other's stories, not try to fix anything, but let folks know, if you ever need it, I'm right here. I'll take an end. I'll hear your story.
I agree. It's a great start. 100%.
Yeah. So I guess that's what kind of like... You know, we can lead into a little bit of some of that stuff because there's still kind of a few things that I want to talk about. But you have a book coming out, and this is also a book that is out, I should say.
The book's out?
Yeah, the book's out.
Okay, great.
So Puzzle Pieces in the Park is what it's called.
Helping kids through tough times.
Yeah, so obviously, like, this is leading to some of this stuff. So, I mean, give us a little overview of that and and talk about, obviously, I can hear from the way we've journeyed through this conversation even here now what some of this probably relates to. And you know, I know you have the Brodies and, you know, your book there had...
What's the Brodies?
So that's his Facebook page and talking about counseling and things like that. And so I'll let you unload on everything here because he talks about gremlin taming and I don't know who Rick Carson is, but... There's teachings in that, so I'll let you unload on all
that.
Okay,
I want to hear about gremlin taming first.
Yeah. It's not owning your mugwa and not feeding them after midnight. It's not that.
No. So Rick Carson is probably one of the most lovely people on this planet.
Okay.
Yeah, he's a fellow who lives down in Texas, and in 1983 he wrote a book called Taming Your Gremlin.
Taming Your Gremlin. I like that title.
The gremlin is that voice that you hear in your head. And please know that I know you have one.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And why do I know you have one? Because we all have one.
Yeah, sure.
And we all have this little... And that this gremlin will tell you things like you're not big enough, you're not strong enough, you're not fast enough, you're not smart enough.
Sure.
Everyone has
that. And also can have anger and other emotions too, right?
All kinds of stuff coming from that little creature's voice. And so he wrote this in 1983. It's sold over 400,000 copies. It's gone around the world, been translated into 7 or 8 different languages. And he's just such a great guy. And when you read the book, you'd swear you're talking to a Texan. You know, the way that he writes it so you read it slow.
Got those Dr. Phil style analogies all in there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just fantastic. Well, I read that in 2003 when I was working with the military and I'm trying to incorporate some models into how we were going to relate to each other going overseas. So our guys went overseas with some gremlin taming skills in their back pocket. But It's a characteristic of mine that I'm really not very shy. So when I read Rick's book in 2003, I thought, well, I need to talk to this guy.
Yeah.
And so I got in touch with him.
2003. So he wrote an 83.
Yeah.
So what's that, 20 years later? Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I got in touch with him and said, listen, read your book, really love your book.
Yeah.
And he was really generous and kind. He became a mentor of mine. I studied underneath him in the gremlin taming approach. And during the military, I was a mediator and I was a coach helping folks go through some difficult times.
Okay.
But I remember any time that I butted up against something that would be determined to be a mental health issue, I was always told, you can't go there, so you have to take this client by the hand and guide them down to a psychologist and they'll be worked with. And I thought, okay. So I did that. And then after I left the military, I went and worked with the police and had that same kind of caveat in my head. If it's mental health, I have to take it down. So in my 50s, I wanted to know what was behind that door. You never go to McDonald's and you see that door that says authorized personnel only.
Yeah, sure.
You ever wonder what's really behind there? You know, what's going on there? So I wanted to know what was behind that door around mental health care. And so I went back to university and did a graduate program in counseling psychology.
Okay.
Came to find out that so much of the material that I'd learned from Rick Carson and the gremlin taming approach, because it was based on Gestalt therapy and so much of the things that I'd read from Carl Rogers and some other icons, there wasn't much difference between what I was doing and what a psychologist could do.
Yeah.
During my practicum, though, because Rick is such a dear man to me, And I'd studied mindful self-compassion from Kristen Neff and Christopher Grimmer as well. So I was squishing together mindful self-compassion with gremlin taming, with the gremlin taming processes. I got in touch with Rick and I said, Rick, I'm doing the practice now and I want to cite your work, but I'm not able to find much of it in on the scientific databases. And I said, can you help me understand that? And Rick said, sure, Tim. I just didn't have time. Rick, we have to rate that wrong. And so I started doing interviews with them so I could use the interviews to cite during my practicum. And then I had this one client who was a 12-year-old girl who was having some really, really difficult challenges. And so I called up Rick and I said, Rick, I'm wanting to know, I want to work with this 12-year-old. Does the gremlin taming process apply exactly the same with a 12-year-old as it does with an adult? And he said, well, you have to change some of the language and you have to tweak a few things. And I said, Rick, why didn't you never ever write a book for kids? And he said, well, Tim, I just didn't have time. So I said, all right, we're going to write that wrong as well.
Cool.
So I committed to Rick that I'd write 4 books for him.
And so you're going to write a kid's book?
Yeah, the first one's already out.
Yeah, oh, okay. That's the puzzle.
Yeah. So there's 4 books. There's one for kids up to age 5. There's another for kids up to age 12. And then another for kids in their teens. And then the last one is for parents on how to parent their kids using the gremlin taming approach. So I wrote the first one, which is like a Dr. Seuss kind of book. And Rick said, no, don't put that one out first, because I believe that Rick watched Star Wars and he understood the way of sequence from Spielberg, right?
Okay.
He said, you should put the second book out first.
Whoa, okay.
Oh, well, all right. So Rick is my mentor, and who am I to say no to him?
Yeah, a bit of fun.
So the second book has just been released. We're having the book launch at the Halifax Club on the 28th.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
I'd love for you guys to come.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Absolutely. Love to.
And Rick is actually flying up.
Let us know the launch date again. We'll make sure we'll put a link on this episode to where you can buy this book and link you to Tim as well. So for
appreciate
any information,
appreciate it. But Nancy Reagan is going to host night.
Cool. Yeah.
Dave Carroll's going to come along.
He's going to
sing some songs,
and
Rick Carson and I are going to sit down and have a conversation with Nancy for about 20 minutes, half an hour.
Jeez.
About the basis for gremlin taming and how the books came to be.
Yeah. Love to talk with Rick Carson. Even we can get him for a 5-minute clip as a follow-up on the 28th. That'd be pretty cool.
He'd be thrilled. He'd be thrilled. So he's coming up. He's coming up 25th. The 26th, we're creating a video about the transition from gremlin taming to gremlin taming for kids.
Yeah.
And then the Sunday, we're going shark fishing.
Okay.
You know, I've got Rick. He's 79 now, and this is the first time he's been to Nova Scotia. He can't come to Nova Scotia without being on the water.
Right? That's true.
Yeah. Shark fishing.
Out Eastern Passageway, you think?
Yes.
Cool.
Yeah. And then the Monday, we're going down to the Halifax Club and launching the book properly. With celebration.
Wow. Yeah.
Awesome.
Oh, yeah. That's very exciting.
Yeah. Come down. It'd be great to see you.
Absolutely. So, Tim, you keep some very interesting company, and you obviously get to meet a lot of interesting people. And, I hope this podcast takes us to the same level that you were at, kind of thing, because you got to meet, I think, a couple times someone who I have a great deal of respect for, and that's General Romeo Dallaire.
For the people that don't know, who is General Romeo Dallaire?
Yeah, I'll let Tim, because people shouldn't have to hear from me. So
okay.
I'll let Tim explain who he is, what he's done, and why he's a great man.
Yeah, he really is. He's one of my North Stars. And look at here's something that I want everyone to hear. You got to figure out who your North Stars are. In Canada, we don't do a good job of claiming heroes.
Okay.
And we need to start labeling our heroes and saying them proudly. And Romeo Dallaire is one of mine. He's definitely one of my heroes. And so by that I mean, you know, he's a North Star when my life is really, really dark. Mm. I look to Romeo Dallaire and I find my way home again. I find my way to the better part of me. And Romeo Dallaire, his big story came from Rwanda when he was there on a peacekeeping mission just before the genocide happened. And Romeo had been ordered out when the Hutus were rising up and wanting to lay waste to the Tutsi minority population. In the span of 900,000 people were killed.
Oh my God.
Romeo had been the general in charge of the peacekeeping mission there, and he was ordered out, ordered to leave before the massacre, and he refused the order. He said, someone has to bear witness to this, mm-hmm. and I'll let anyone from my team go home that wants to go home, but he's such an impeccable leader that no one did. No one, they all stayed with him, and they witnessed the horror of a genocide. And it caused extreme damage to Romeo's soul. He struggled with post-traumatic stress.
And what year was this when this happened?
Gosh, you're asking me a question after a drama llama.
I know. I'm sorry.
It was in the 90s.
It was in the 90s.
Early 90s.
Early 90s. Okay.
I think it was 92 or 93.
Okay.
I could be wrong.
Yeah.
Wow.
So he came home and he suffered greatly. He's written a couple books, and one of them was Shake Hands with the Devil, about his mm-hmm. experience at the start. And he wrote another book called Waiting for First Light, about his experience with post-traumatic stress. Then he wrote another book about child soldiers. They fight like men that die like children. And I don't think I could find a better example for anyone about what it means to be a hero, and that notion that I was telling you about before, a man willing to sacrifice his all for the betterment of the world. You know, his struggle with post-traumatic stress was so profound. He tried to kill himself repeatedly. He struggled with alcoholism and yet still continued to serve. He became a senator in the Canadian government, and then he came here into Nova Scotia, where he created the Dallaire Initiative, which is now the Dallaire Institute at Dalhousie University, working to eradicate the use of child soldiers around the world. And so that's become his mission. And I remember I had the chance to participate in this program for about 6 months. And the very first day that I went, he came in the room, and it was just like, you know, I looked like the girls at the Ed Sullivan Show when the Beatles were on. You know?
The hero or North Star, as you put it. Yeah.
Yeah.
There are very few people that I would actually like to have on this podcast that like are like my top, like top. If you'd like say, give me a wish list of five, he's one of them.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
We'll get him on here.
Maybe.
I believe. I'd love to. I believe we can do it.
I bet you will.
Yeah, I think you will. Matthew, man, I think we got to wrap this up, buddy. We're going for...
The only last thing that I want to kind of cover off with Tim is, because it is such an important thing, is I wanted you to just kind of... Because we talked about the book and talked about some of that stuff, but I'd like you to kind of quickly talk about the Society of Atlantic Heroes, because it's an important cause, and you know we want to shed some light on that.
Yeah. Society of Atlantic Heroes was something I volunteered with, and then just before COVID, Ken Hoffer, who was the president, decided that he needed to leave the Society of Atlantic Heroes and move on to other things. And in all sincerity, I didn't want this job. I was really, really, really busy, but it was going to close.
Right.
And so I said, okay, I'll take it on. And then COVID happened. So Society of Atlantic Heroes, we're a not-for-profit. We have an apartment, a three-bedroom apartment that's like Ronald McDonald House for veterans, first responders here in Halifax. If they're in the city and their family is attending medical procedures or they are, we've got a place for them to stay. During COVID, we lost all our donor base, and we nearly had to close, but we're fighting back. We're at 95% occupancy rate right now. Some stories that will just would make you cry if you heard them about that, the folks that we're serving. And now we're fighting for corporate sponsors, and I think that we found one.
Oh, wow.
And it's a really, really cool guy. It's Humana Humana Animation Studios. Sounds cool.
Okay.
That's awesome.
Right across the harbor from us in Dartmouth. And Adamina, who's my neighbor, he owns the studios, but he also owns this television network called Toonavision, and it's a cartoon network for kids.
Okay.
And so we're going to be putting on a fundraiser in October during Nocturne, and he's sponsoring it. He's asking professional animators from across the Atlantic region to create a brand new hero. And he's going to hand out awards for the top heroes from the animators that come in, and then we're going to auction off all the artwork, and all the money that comes from the artwork auction will come towards the Society of Atlantic Heroes.
Wow!
Supporting those who serve us, I think it's going to be wonderful.
That's cool.
Yeah,
that's very cool.
I'll have to get the pad and pen out and see if I can draw a hero.
Maybe you can draw a hero.
Yeah,
I used to be able to draw back in the day.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Practice makes perfect, and I have been practicing.
Yeah.
But that's so cool. So,
thanks for asking.
I wanted to bring it up because, I mean, there's so many good things that you had to do, and I honestly really, really appreciate you coming out. Obviously, hopefully people will enjoy this as much as I did having this conversation with you.
Yeah, thank you. I enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Because there was really a lot of interesting things there and a really, I think, unique perspective that you bring that I think people will find interesting. Yeah. So thank you very much, Tim.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for the mugs.
Yeah.
Thanks for the challenge.
Challenge coins. These are cool.
Yeah. And so I think we can end this off with a cheers. Again, one final cheers. Yeah.
Fantastic, guys.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of The Afternoon Pint. If you have an idea for the show or would like to be a part of it, email us at afternoonpint@gmail.com.